We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
All right, man. So I get a call from one of my good informants, and I answer the phone, and he says nothing but, "Yo, Ski, we robbing a bank today." And I said, "Oh, okay. This should be interesting." So I get the details, man, and he knows a dude that approached him and asked him if he wants to rob a bank. And the beauty is he already knows this guy is out on parole for bank robbery.
Oh.
Yes. Doesn't get any better than that, man. So I get the details, and I go to my sergeant, and I say, "Sarge, you want to rob a bank today?" And he said, "Yeah, what are we waiting for?" So Operation Bank Robbery is in full swing. And how it went down is pretty awesome, man. So the guy that wants to rob a bank, his first problem is he doesn't have a car.
Okay.
My informant also doesn't have a car, but Ski happens to drive a city-issued unmarked vehicle.
Okay.
And my sergeant says, "Well, they're going to use your car to rob a bank today." I'm like, okay. I liked it at first, but then I started to get a little hesitant. But like, we were committed, man. We've already made phone calls. We've already got FBI Safe Streets Task Force on board. Like, we've got a lot of people interested in putting a guy that's out on parole for bank robbery back in prison for bank robbery. Mm-hmm. So we get we partner up using some of our bordering jurisdictions, like I said, the FBI, some other bordering jurisdictions, and we have all this equipment that we rig my unmarked car up with. Mm-hmm. And it's got like 3 GPS trackers on it, so we definitely are not going to lose it. Yeah. It's got audio all over the vehicle. I mean, it took us a little while to put it together, but we did it. Mm-hmm. And then we hit the go button, and we throw the keys to the informant, and we search the car like 100 times, because it is a police car, to make sure there's not handcuffs or badge or, you know, whatever it is we lose in our cars laying around. So we throw the informant the keys, and he's pretty excited. He's going to go pick up a guy, and they're going to come up with a bank robbery, you know, or go do a bank robbery. And what we didn't realize is the guy really didn't have a plan. He just asked the informant, he's like, "Hey, right. You want to do a bank robbery with me?" And I think the informant got excited and was like, "Oh, yeah, we're doing it." So, like, they didn't even come up with a plan. So, like, we gave him my car. He goes and picks the guy up, and then we're listening on the audio. I'm like, these sons of bitches don't even have a plan together yet, right?
Right.
So, couple ground rules so it doesn't sound negligent. Mm-hmm. Absolutely no weapons. Mm-hmm. So, my guy was like, "Listen, dude, like, I'm going to help you, but you're not using a gun, you're not using a knife, you're not using any weapons. We're just going to go in, and we're going to hand him a note, and we're going to rob a bank that way." So, that worked out, but they finally pick a location, which also took another, it felt like 2 hours.
Right.
And we're in route to there, and we've got people in place, and, you know, we're not going to let them get into the bank, obviously. We're going to let it go as if they're going to commit the act, and pre-alerted the bank. They locked the doors, the whole 9 yards. So they're on their way to their destination, and they make a hard turn into a gas station. Like a real hard turn. And on the audio, you hear the guy. So the bad guy ends up driving my car, which that was not part of the plan. Uh-huh. So he's driving my car, right? And like, this is all kind of whacked out. But and you hear on the audio, he goes, "Yo, I got to take a shit." And they pull into a gas station parking lot. Bad guy jumps out. Informant's calling us like, "Yo, he's got to take a shit." Like, duh, yeah, we're listening on the bug, man.
Right. Yeah.
So I got bad guy driving my car, just comes out of a gas station bathroom, nice fresh shit in his britches. Now they're going to rob a bank. So They get to their destination. They park. They walk quite a distance. They get into the parking lot. They're making their final approach on the door. And dang, they were greeted in the best way possible with FBI and local SWAT, the whole nine yards. And needless to say,
yeah,
he was in handcuffs. Even my informant said that takedown was so scary. I knew it was coming, and it scared me.
Yeah. But it's kind of designed that way there, right?
That was it, man. Like, and you know, you don't tell the informant everything. They're on a need to know basis. They're not on your squad. They're just relaying information. Now, this guy was credible and reliable, and we did put a lot of, I guess, you know, we put a lot of clout in what he was saying and what he was going to actually do for us. But it's because we've used him a ton, and we trusted him enough that we could do this in a controlled manner, and we could do this safely, you know, without. You know, so yeah, no, it was awesome. So that's my claim to fame, that successfully coordinated a bank robbery while being a sworn police officer using my undercover police car.
Yeah. So a few things first. One is the movies always show bank robbery suspects or bank robberies is like, you know, just all this planning going into place, and you know, we got to get these two or three different vehicles are going to be ditching, and they're all using like sterile equipment. You know what I mean? Like it just goes overboard. But basically this dude just got up and said, hey, let's go rob a bank. Like, I don't have a car. I don't have a gun. I don't really have anything.
They made, aside from committing to rob the bank, they made the plans like in the car, like where are we going? Like, I mean, it was frustrating because we thought like all that was already taken care of. But
yeah, what people sometimes forget is if someone gets away with a bank robbery once and they don't get caught, then usually they're going to hit it again and again and again, until they get caught. So
absolutely.
If you didn't have an informant, you'd have had a dude robbing a bank who probably would have gotten away with it. Maybe. I say probably. It just depends.
Yeah, I mean, and that's a good point. That's a really good point. Had we not intervened, and I know it almost sounds, some people might go, oh, man, that's kind of crazy and almost a little negligent, but he was going to go rob a bank that day anyways, and he just so happened to ask the wrong dude to help him.
Yeah, yeah. So for a lot of people that don't deal with informants, and they don't understand like how things like that go on, because that wasn't a news story, I'm sure. It didn't make the news. Like people weren't saying, oh, there's almost a bank robbery today. Like that's not newsworthy.
Nope.
So a lot of people don't know like the amount of violent crime that gets disrupted through using informants or CIs, right? People say confidential informant. Sometimes just using the term source. Like I'll say that a lot of times we'll just say, hey, I got this source because I may come across information from, you know, like a third party who's not an actual signed up, you know, CI, confidential informant or confidential source on paperwork with a code name that most people are always asking about or talking about, like, oh, what's it like working informants? Or probably the burning question of the day is, do people even still use informants?
Mm. I hope so. Yeah,
I do too, because it is a dying art. Definitely. It's not a science, but there's an art to,
well, it definitely falls into the proactive policing wheelhouse.
Yes,
for sure. You know, it's not, it's just another tool, but it does fall in that proactive measure. And, so we have, what did you say? Source, confidential informant, which is CI is the acronym for that. And what are they called on the streets, BC?
Well, they used to say snitch.
And what happens to a snitch?
They say snitches get stitches.
You know what I say?
What?
Snitches get paid.
Well, they get riches. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Snitches get riches. So
the interesting thing is when I talk about informants, or when you've talked about informants, or anybody else that does this line of work, people who don't work informants will often fall into the belief that gang members and hardcore drug dealers will never snitch. Like, they'll go to the grave, like, I never snitch on anybody. When the truth or the reality is what?
A lot of them talk. And most, they have a lot of different motivations behind why they do, but especially in the drug world, and that's more so where I can speak on, is because I worked drugs and gangs, was even as a patrol officer, that was just my, that's what I did. I just,
what are the motivations?
Oh, there's a couple different. Obviously, I think the most obvious one that most people would think of is somebody gets charged, and maybe the DA makes a an agreement with them that says, hey, you're looking at 10 years in prison. However, if you provide, you know, good, credible, reliable information, and we can make X amount of felony arrests or cases, you might only be looking at 3 years, right? And that's just an example. I'm just kind of throwing numbers out there. But so one of their motivations is working off charges.
Yeah. So if somebody's working off charges, like you just said, they get a sentence reduction. So a lot of people, when we're talking, and they'll say, oh, well, of course, someone would give up information. If you say they can snitch on three different people and they get a sentence reduction, why would they not do that? But it's not that easy. It's not like someone just sits down and says, citizen A sells cocaine, citizen B sells heroin, and citizen C sells Molly. And then you just run out there and arrest them for the information.
No, the first test is, you know, so if you're squared away and you're locked in, and when you're in the drug world and the gang world, you learn your area, right? So you know, for the most part, who your key players are, you know, locations, you know, what kind of weight's coming through, you know, that section of the city you're working or whatever that is. So the first thing you do, like, you know, let's say, you know, I don't want to get way ahead of myself, but let's say you charge somebody, and just like we're talking about, the DA agrees, that the DA looks at this person's criminal history and says, yeah, I'll work with them. So the DA will get up with the attorney of the defendant and say, hey, we're willing to work if your client wants to provide information, and this is the terms, and they'll actually draft up a contract that the informant has to fulfill, right? And now it's all good, because you're doing it through the court system. You're not just doing it on your own. You've included the DAs, the prosecutors, yeah, and all the right people, right? So now, to answer your question, what you're going to do is you're going to sit down and you're going to vet some information. The first thing I'm going to do is just say, hey, tell me what you know. And a lot of times you'll run into that, you know, people are withholding information. Like I said, if you know your area and you ask a couple nicknames and they want to play dumb, and you say, like, dude, you're not a crack dealer in this city if you can't tell me who these three people are. And if you're not even going to be truthful about that, we're done. I'm going to go to the DA, say you're not interested in cooperating, and we're walking out the door.
So, and if they start providing information, and you're vetting it, so like you just said, if this happens a lot, they just lay out generic terms like, oh yeah, hey, they sell heroin at this hotel. And you're like, yeah, I know they sell heroin at a hotel. Give me some details. You know what I mean? Like, you have to get this information from them. So if someone provides very detailed information to you, then you're saying that then you just go out and you can start to verify.
Yeah. Yeah. The next step is that corroboration or verification of that information. So if they say, let's say hypothetically, every Tuesday night at 8 PM at this hotel, this guy shows up in this car with this tag number, and you go on a Tuesday at that time to that hotel and you see that guy in that car with that tag number. Okay, that's good, right? So now you're starting to corroborate information. Now, there is case law and different stuff that kind of dictates if that's enough probable cause to act, or if, you know, you have reasonable suspicion, you can get into that. But now what you do is you go, okay, he's provided some good information. Now you sit back and watch and start drawing your own, developing your own probable cause. And that's another cool thing, is you don't have to rely all on their information. They can, that, you know, what's that saying? You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. Well, they can lead you to the water, and then it's your, you know, your choice to drink, for lack of a better term. And that is just doing your own investigation up to that point.
Right. A little, you went a little George Bush on me, George Bush Jr. there. You lead a horse to water, but you can't make him smoke the drugs. Yeah, no. Well, that's one of the things. So, you know how it is. You start talking to people, especially like nowadays, and I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent, but nowadays, like when I'm talking to people, people are getting very upset about the idea of informants in police work. So oftentimes people are saying that. They're like, I don't understand this, that a person just gives information. But like you just said, if they're detailed in the information, and you go out and you start to verify, and then you go, okay, what this person is telling me is true. Then you also test it by asking them questions about things that you already know the answers to, and that they should know the answers to.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm sorry, I walked on you. That's that initial interview of just like, hey, start telling me what you know. And then if you can get through step one, then you go to step two. And that's when you go out into the field and start that corroboration process. But like in the 60s, the courts decided, you know, the Aguilar-Spinelli two-prong test to determine the validity and likeliness of information provided by an informant, right? So you have to establish the informant's knowledge, and that's what that first step. And then you have to provide facts establishing the credibility of the informant, or the you know, the specific reliability of the informant. And the burden is on us as the officer, as the person handling that informant, to prove how credible and reliable that informant is.
So in the scenario, like you just said, yep. Which that was pretty impressive. So the scenario you just said, you start to corroborate it, and you start to see, okay, one, this person's being honest, or, you know, being truthful about this information. This is information you can now work. That's someone who's basically working off their charges.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Yep.
So they're self-motivated to work the charges off. What about someone who works for money?
Yeah, absolutely. So for financial gain, that's a whole nother motive. And for me, that one is a little more dangerous in mm-hmm. the sense of, you know, if you're on charges and you're working on a contract with the DA, you already know what the consequences are if you don't follow through, right? You're going to get a longer prison sentence. But somebody working for financial gain, they don't really have anything to lose. They have everything to gain, which is that profit, that money, right? Mm-hmm. And if you've been around this world at all, man, and informants can actually make some pretty good money. And there's even people that BC and I know that have literally made enough money to make it a full-time job.
Yeah. Yeah.
Traveling the country with different FBI, yeah. DEA, federal, state, local, you name it. There are informants out there that literally make enough money to make a living doing just that.
And that is one aspect, I think, that when we start telling people about it, like people who are not in that realm, the average citizen, or even people in law enforcement, but who don't get to do a lot of the proactive side, they would probably be shocked to know the amount of money someone can make as an informant. But the whole idea of that is you're paying someone for their time, and it is a risk, and it is a necessity if we want to prevent crime. A perfect example is like the story you told earlier, like we just said, that prevented one bank robbery and also probably future bank robberies, because if he would have gotten away with it once, he would have done it more, probably would have had a pattern. We used to do the same thing early on patrol, when you would develop almost like temporary informants that you would encounter on the street who were either, you know, committing burglaries, or they're committing, you know, like they're buying drugs, they're ingesting the drugs, but they're not selling them. You know what I'm saying? Like they're just the addict doing things to survive. And so there were times, even as a young patrol officer, where you could sign somebody up like that, and they, people still do it now, but as an informant, and they work temporarily, they make some money. And a lot of times, like we were able to break burglary patterns that way. We were able to make arrests in very strategic locations using a person who would go in and maybe buy from the local dealer, where you wire them up, you know, you're recording everything. It's audio, it's visual. You've got eyes on them the whole time. They go in, they do an exchange with money that we know the serial numbers to, so we can actually even track that money when it's in someone's pocket. And this is, we're not giving away any tricks here. This is to explain, this is how we do it, so that we can explain the case if it goes to trial, and to also prove that this was a drug transaction. This was the money that we had the serial numbers recorded, and that money was recovered off of this person in their pocket, or, you know, later in a vehicle or something that they were driving as they were driving away. But this idea of using people sometimes temporarily is actually cool in a way when you get to sit down and talk to someone and they go, look, I didn't even know this was an option. I didn't know I could work as an informant. I didn't know I could get paid for my time.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Then, yeah. And then when you're working them, and you probably got a lot of stories too about it, when you're working informants, especially, at least for me, if someone is addicted or they're battling hardships in life and they need that money, and they're trying to change their life, you can sit there and talk to them about getting a job or getting a better job or what some of the future goals are. It's almost like for some people, their life slows down long enough to where they can go, oh, I never thought about it this way. It's almost like being a therapist, sort of like when you're talking.
Oh yeah. And I want to get into that side of the relationships between officers and informants. And I think this is a super important topic. Before I do, so you have an informant that is working off charges. You have the ones that want to work for money, for financial gain. And there's only a few other, you know, types out there. You have your mercenary, and that's somebody that's trying to get back at someone. Mm-hmm. That's your revenge informant, but your mercenary informant is somebody that's like somebody that wants to be a police officer, and they're kind of into like what they almost like they're not a sworn officer, but they want to be, and they're kind of like on their own taking the crime into their own hands, and they want to help you.
Well, let me say this. So some people may go, oh, well, that's dangerous because that person is now thinking they're an officer or an agent or something. It's probably kind of hard to explain, but there are people who are very capable of providing information and doing really great stuff, either because of where they work or they live, or they're related to somebody, or they're just in an environment where they're like, I can get that information. I had a guy that, because of certain locations he was in and out of and the way he looked. So it's great because, you know, the buzzword right now is implicit bias, and a lot of training for officers to understand that, hey, this is implicit bias, that sort of thing. It's across the board. Gang members see other people and go, oh, that dude looks like me, therefore he must be like me. And so this dude was very good at blending in mold. Like, he was like a chameleon. Wherever he went, he could talk about almost any type of music. He could hang out with bikers. He could hang out with gang members. He could hang out with military people. I mean, like, because he was just a nice guy. This was not a guy that was committing crimes. But all of a sudden, it's like, you know, he gets a little age on him. He realizes there's a lot of really bad stuff going on. And at the time, he couldn't be a cop. So he was just like, look, I got information and this is what I've got. That dude worked some amazing cases, all from a distance, just from people talking or bragging. It's amazing. But that also gave him an opportunity to make money and to clean up areas and the things that he saw. And it made him feel better. I mean, that's what we used to talk about. You know, we talk about music and everything else. He's like, man, this feels good. I feel like I'm doing something with my life. I'm like, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Well, let me paint this picture too, because you're talking about just where he's putting himself and just what he's seeing and hearing. when you're a patrol officer and you start out, you're the only crimes you're finding is if somebody calls 911 to report something, or you're driving around proactively looking for things that you're trained to look for, right? So think of the informant as this whole new tool that you have into this criminal world out there, and they're literally a phone call away, or they're the eyes and ears that you wish you were, and now all of a sudden you have that. You say, hey, can you go to this apartment complex? There's always a group of people hanging out at night. Can you just go in and tell me what's up, right? They're an extension of you when you're working them, and that's just so cool to be able to kind of infiltrate like that and be able to get that type of information. And it's just for those that have never been in law enforcement or, you know, worked informants, that's the cool thing is you're getting real time information directly from a source. And, you know, it's as good as it gets.
So when I said earlier about it being an art, that's one of the things that I learned early on that kept me interested in police work. Is that I was around some sergeants and detectives who were like, if you want to be a real cop, if you want to go out there and do what you're supposed to do for our area, because we're experiencing so much violence and so many gangs, so many open air drug markets, they were like, this is what you got to do. You got to develop sources. You would actually show me, hey, this is the packet of paperwork you got to fill out. This is how you handle them. You know, and so I would watch some of the interactions. And what's interesting is some people, and this is a while back, you know, some people were very, like heavy handed. It would almost be like, oh, we caught you with whatever, an 8-ball of coke. So now you got to work. And it was almost like adversarial. I never understood that.
So no.
Sometimes, you know, that's got the drug charge, they go, well, you know, you see the body language, they look up at the sky almost like, okay, what do I do? I'll work. Right. And then, but then it's almost like they're butting heads. I never liked that. I always would just talk to people and say,
no. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to give the, there's definitely an art to it. And this goes back to just rapport building and how you treat people in general as a police officer. But, you know, you make a good case on somebody and maybe you catch somebody with a significant weight of cocaine and it's a trafficking charge and they know what kind of penalty that holds. They maybe know that their criminal history is pretty terrible and they know they're already looking at some time. And you instead of saying, oh, you know, you can go to prison or you can work for me, you say, hey, man, you're in a bad spot right now because, you know, this you know your record. I know your record. We got you dead to rights. You already know that. There are options if you're willing to talk about it. That's a way better approach because that opens the gate. Because I've had people go, hey, I'm not saying shit. You can take me to jail right now. Don't waste my time. Don't waste your time. And you already know, like that person at that time, they're not ready to talk about anything. Doesn't mean you can't reapproach them later. But the guy that wants to say, hey, you know, I'm listening. You know, give me some options. And that's the approach I like to take.
Yeah. And it seemed to be about the same time that things were shifting that we started doing like some of the assignments we did together where we're actually taking active gang members and what we call flipping. So for listeners, when you hear us say terms like flipping, in this sense, it means you encounter a gang member. And I'm going to get into just real quickly some of the details of how you do that. But you flip them, meaning that they are in a gang, but they are going to get on board. They're going to actually provide information about the gang itself or even a rival gang, and they may not want to talk about their own gang.
Let me ask you a question. When you're flipping somebody, is this just a spontaneous thing or is this a deliberate person that you're seeking out to go, hey, I want to put a charge on this person because I think they have valuable information for us in our investigation? Or is it a mix? Or how do you go about that strategy?
So you can do spontaneous flips, and that is, but that you got to really, I mean, you got to kind of know people, you got to know the area, you've got to know the gang, the history, and people who are really good at that are going to be good at any aspect of police work for the most part. But that is when you encounter someone at, say, I don't know, 2 in the morning, whatever, and you've got them on a misdemeanor charge like trespassing, or I don't know, driving without a license or something like that. You encounter this person, but you read the vibes. You know, they've got gang tattoos you can articulate, gang attire. You're like, okay, I got the vibe of that. And you just start to build that rapport and talk to them about it. That's very tough. Like a few people are really good at that, but for the most part, that's tough to do. The most of the sources or whatever that you develop, you already kind of know who the person is. You start to learn more about their background. Maybe like this person has a girlfriend that got mad at them. They beat her, you know, and then she files a report. Then you find out, okay, well, he's beat this girl, but in the report, it kind of states something about their feud or their problems or whatever. So you're like, okay, now this person's dealing with some stress, but now I know where he's laying his head down. So now I can do a little more research, read more reports he's in, talk to other people maybe that he knows, look at the crimes he's already committed, talk to other informants.
Yeah. So backing up on what you said, you know, on the officer side, it does take a lot of knowledge to be able to do that. And I'm just recalling a guy that I eventually got working for me, somebody that I knew, I never met him face to face, but I knew of him and I knew a lot about him and I knew everything there was to know about the gang he ran with. And it was like 3 o'clock in the morning one night and a suspicious vehicle pulled up and lo and behold, he's in the passenger seat. And I start talking to him and I'm using some terminology that's very, very specific to his gang and his neighborhood. And he's kind of looking at me like, you know, when you make a funny noise and a dog turns their head sideways.
Yeah.
He's kind of looking at me like this guy knows something. So I'm giving him just enough to keep his interest. This is just my initial approach with him. And I'm just saying all sorts of stuff to him. I'm reading some of his tattoos and I'm basically telling him what that means and this and that. And he finally stopped and he's like, yo, who are you? And how do you know so much about me? I was like, I've never met you, man. I don't know anything about you. He goes, okay, then you're creeping me out, man. So like
right.
He instant, I had credibility with him and I actually ended up kind of putting him in a little jam with charge that night. And, you know, did exactly what I just talked about a few minutes ago. And it just given that option. And it was my initial approach that even made him kind of humor the thought, because some of these guys that are out here, like we'll just call them career criminals, they don't want to deal. And this is not a jab at a young officer. You're young and you don't know as much because you don't know as much and you haven't had as much experience, right? But a lot of these career criminals, they don't want to deal with a young officer that's kind of wet behind the ears, still trying to, you know, figure it out. So he knew there was a seasoned officer that really knew and understood what he was involved in. And I think that's what made him comfortable enough to actually sit and have like this man-to-man conversation where I understood his role and rank and he understood where I was coming from. So there was like this mutual respect.
Yeah, the perfect example, like you're saying with that, and for officers out there who don't get frustrated with that, especially if a senior officer or a detective steps in and just kind of hijacks the conversation or not, because they're probably reading the body language. Prime example, if the rule on the street is, you know, no snitching, snitches, you know, you basically, you can get X'd out. Like you can't do, like, this is a death sentence if someone is caught snitching, right? Supposedly. So if a person's going to give their safety or their abilities over and go, okay, I'm willing to cooperate or work with you, it has to be someone who impresses the hell out of them with their knowledge and how they move and how calm they are. Like, that's another thing. Like, someone can't come in there spazzing out and being like, oh yeah, you gonna work for me, or yeah, I want you to work for me. We'll do this, we'll do that. It's a sales pitch, really. So if you're buying a car, you talk to the salesperson, but really the salesperson's gonna go back and talk to us, whatever, the financier, or they're gonna go talk to a person behind the curtain and start getting information and then come back out. Well, really, when I go buy a car, I just want to go in and go, this is the car I want. and where do I sign? This is how much money I'm going to pay for this car. I don't need to listen to you buddy up to me, you know. So it's the same thing. Like if you cut to the chase, like you deal with that dude, you start laying out some particulars too. People are like, oh, and then they go, oh, like here's my lifeline. Here's the guy who's going to actually keep me maybe from going to prison for a very long time.
Absolutely, man. And yeah, I love what you said about laying it out, man. You just, because if you work in a city and there's gangs there and there's drug dealers, there's always ongoing beef. There's never not. So you stay very, very current on ongoing beef, and you make a comment to somebody sitting in a car and say like, oh, I hope Smoke don't get shot tonight. And they kind of look at you like, how did you know that? It's like, you know what I mean? And then that's letting him know, like, you're dialed in. You already know what's happening tonight out on the streets, and maybe Smoke's one of his people. And I'm just throwing that random name out there. It's a nickname you'll hear in any city. So, but yeah, just to kind of, you know, I think we're beating a dead horse with, you know, just the amount of knowledge and information that the officer needs to have. But I like the term, like a kind of a quiet professional. That demeanor, like the act like you've been there for the officer, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of having to, you know, get all, you know, your chest puffed out and tell them how much you know this and that. It's like just general conversation of saying, you know, hey, man, this is where you're at. I already know your whole crew's beefing with this whole crew. My main objective is to make sure that nobody gets killed tonight. I don't want you to get shot. I don't want your best buddy to get shot, or your homies that you roll with, or your girl, or an innocent child. And you know,
rapport. Act like you've been in the end zone and that you plan on returning.
Exactly.
Think about it too this way. If for someone who's listening to this and they're out there and they make an arrest and they're thinking, man, I wonder if this person will be a good informant. If they're celebrating the fact that, and when I say they, the officers, celebrating the fact that they just recovered drugs or a stolen gun or something off of this person, and they're like, oh yeah, I knew I was going to get this, or yeah, you going to jail, or even just a high five and their buddy or whatever, that's going to piss off the person. Obviously it's the worst day of their life because they're getting arrested, potentially going to prison for a very long time. All that's flooding their thoughts. And then here's this officer showing excitement. They're not going to want to work with that person. That officer's taking joy in them going to prison. So it's this idea of when you're talking to people and you make the arrest, to explain to them the errors of their ways. Like, this is the shit you got going on, man. You got a gun charge, you got whatever, a drug charge. You're caught in this cycle of violence. This is the gang that you're in. This is the rank you hold. This is what's going on, the future moves. We know that this is going to happen, right? If it's, hey, we already know so-and-so is going to go to prison, which creates a promotion, so-and-so will probably get that next rank, which means you may have to put in work or whatever, you know. You start to lay it out like that in that tone and talk just like a normal person would, that person is going to be more opt to go, I'm on board, man. How do I save myself in this situation? Now, this is for people who are not very violent. Like, I think that's probably the caveat is, like, when someone is very violent, like they love beef, they love just running around the streets with guns and doing all that rah rah stuff. It's like, that's not who you want to flip or who you
want. You bring up a good point. You know, even somebody might have the best information in the world, but they may just not fit the mold to be an informant. They may be just too bad, too far gone. Like the DA is going to laugh at you if you go, yeah, I understand we got this convicted felon with a stolen handgun and the gun's linked to 3 homicides, but he can give us 3 kilos, right? Like, it's not, that's still on the scale. I think his crimes and what you got him would outweigh the other. So yeah, sometimes you'll make a case on somebody and the DA is like, I don't care if you give me Jimmy Hoffa, you're still not we're not accepting any of your information.
Yeah, and sometimes it should be that way. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I brought up some case law earlier that Spinelli Aguilar and referenced the 60s, but I think it's important to throw out some other cases. In the 80s, they abandoned that whole two-prong thing in Illinois v. Gates. And I don't want to get into the case because that could be boring for people. But if you're an officer, read Illinois v. Gates, where it talks about more of like a common sense judgment about the value of informants' information, and in, you know, and they adopted like the totality of the circumstances and analyzing the probable cause and all that good stuff. So it's a little different. You don't have to meet the two-prong test of the 60s, but Illinois v. Gates kind of changed the way we can take information and how we can prove it or deem it to be credible or reliable, and then the court accepts that. So I just wanted to clear that up because I did bring that up earlier.
Yeah, the one of the easy things to do too, if officers or detectives are out there listening, or someone who is interested in going into police work or is listening, doing research or something for college, and they're like, well, I got a lot of questions about this stuff, just shoot us a message. Like, just DM us that. Believe it or not, like if you're sending questions to us, we can answer them that are probably more specific to their area or even to you know, we're talking about drug informants and gang informants, but there are other crimes that, you know, you can use sources for. So, if somebody's into fraud or whatever, like, you know, shoot us a message. It's more of the art of flipping or understanding why someone would be an informant, and then why do we even use them in law enforcement? Like, because, okay, here's a great example. When I talk about working gangs, and people go, well, how do you know so much about gangs? And I say, oh, it's because of years and years and years and talking to everybody and informants and all this. And people are like, well, oh, so you don't infiltrate gangs. Like, you're not some undercover officer. I'm like, no, I can't. One, I couldn't. I don't know too many street gangs that like read books, sit around like a nerd. Like, I can't infiltrate a gang. It's not in my personality. But if we were to only rely on officers working in an undercover capacity, we are limited to very, very small fraction of the violent crime that occurs. We have to depend on informants for that reason. And not to mention that oftentimes an informant can have years and years and years of information or years and years built up with an organization that we wouldn't necessarily be able to do with an officer or an agent.
Yeah. And that's what I was just going to say, you know, in a city like we're working in that world, there's not a whole lot of people that don't know who BC and Ski are. So we can't, right. I can't put on the fake mustache with the glasses and the big nose and,
right.
You know,
although I will say, I did a drug assignment for like, I don't know, whatever it was, like 2 years or a year. And that's really all we did was street drugs. And so I grew everything out, you know, and dressed down and all that. And there was a guy talking, and I was being quiet. This was a guy was getting arrested. He was selling, this is just like a couple crack rocks. And another detective was trying to flip him. And the guy was like looking at that detective and said, no, like, I ain't working with you. I'm not taking you to no drug deals. Like, I'm not, not you. And he looks at me, he's like, but that dude right there looks like he would buy from me. So I just start kind of laughing because I was like, oh, okay. So it's also that idea of like that guy looked at me and said, yeah, like you look like some of my customers. But
I'm not going to lie, man. When you were in that phase of your career and your life, you did look a little terrible. Rough, man.
I looked terrible.
I got
denied entry into one of our stations twice. once the officer had actually held the door shut and wouldn't let me walk into the corridor of the area. And I'd forgotten. I wasn't thinking of the way I look.
Right.
I was thinking like, I mean, I got to get in here. I got to talk to this dude. I got to get this evidence put up. Like, I had 100 things I had to get done. It's like, sir, this is a restricted area. You can't come in here. So then I had to, you know, show my badge. But But when I stopped and thought about it, I was like, yeah, to an officer who didn't know who I was looking the way I did, he probably thought something was up. Hell, I walked into an interview room. A person was arrested for some drug charges and was in an interview room, and another detective was going to go in and do the debrief and all that. But in the meantime, I was like, well, I'll just pop my head in there, make sure if they need some food, water, whatever they need. So I popped my head in. I was like, hey, do you need anything?
And he's like, yo, throw me the handcuff key, man.
This person was like,
how'd you get your cuffs off?
Yeah, this person was just like, can I get a chicken sandwich? I was like, yeah, I've got a Chick-fil-A good. Yeah. So I went and got Chick-fil-A and a drink, came back. And the person's like, thanks. The detective goes in there, and somehow it comes out in a conversation later. They thought I was like a maintenance, like a maintenance worker working on the air conditioner or something. And I just happened to pop my head and like, I'm going to go get lunch.
That's awesome.
I was like, no, I had to explain to them, like, no, I'm part of the team that you're going to be.
Yeah,
be working with for a little while. But
hey, you did a good job of blending in, man. But I mean, it wasn't that far from your regular street attire, which makes it even more fun. Like, you weren't trying to be that guy. You were born to do that, man.
This was the best part about it, was a lot of detectives didn't really know me, because I had worked in a certain district and then worked gangs for, you know, like whatever it was, like 2 years or something. We were on a street level gang unit. So we're, you know, kind of isolated from that. I wasn't, you know, around some of these other detectives. And I remember, I don't know, after a few months on that unit, you know, everything was, hair was growing out, goatee, all that stuff. And, but I'm wearing just my regular clothes that I would normally wear off duty. And a detective comes over and he's just like, man, you look legit. Like you look like a dude that could go and buy drugs like right now. And I'm like, oh yeah, thanks. Like, where'd you get those clothes? Like, my closet.
Yeah, like, man. Like,
that's how you dress? Like, yeah.
So on the department we worked for, we actually didn't have officers that were quote unquote undercover officers, right? We had plainclothes officers that kind of same ballpark, but like, you didn't have officers that were, you know, like you would see in a movie, like Serpico is a perfect example of, you know, that guy did some really cool badass stuff, but that was different and back in the day. So like, the department we worked for, we didn't have undercover officers, so we weren't out doing our own buys, but we were facilitating all that stuff, utilizing informants.
Yeah, I don't know too many agencies, I mean, other than the big cities, that can get away with that. Like, a lot of the smaller cities, even though they're still large, I mean, anything under like 1 million people, you're still battling a small underworld.
I'm out one day and I got two of my coworkers, two dudes on my squad. It's just me, my sergeant, and one other, my partner. And we were actually looking, and I'm driving like a minivan and completely unmarked, but we're looking for a warrant suspect. And we were trying to do some surveillance, and I have this guy's bebopping up the street, and I see he's like beelining right towards us. And I'm like, all right, let's just sit here. And I'm driving, and he comes right up to my window, and he's like, yo, 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 yo. He's a user, right? And I'm trying to do a funny impression. But he's like, what you need? What you need? And I realize, all right, he's trying to hook me up with something. I'm thinking he's literally just going to pull some crack out and just hand it to me. I was like, oh, just give me a 20 rock, man. Just a 20 rock, and we'll be good to go, man. And I pulled some cash out like I was about to buy. He's like, oh, hold on, man. I'll be right back. I'll be right back. So he's the solicitor. So this is really, really funny. So he goes down the street and he gets the dealer, who's a known gang member that I know really well. He knows me really well. The best part about it is he has no idea that his man that's out drumming up work for him is sending him to a van with three cops in there that he personally knows already, right? Yeah, so I see him round the corner and he's coming up to make the sale, and I'm like, my sergeant and my partner are like, yo, that's so-and-so. I'm like, oh, this is gonna be good. We're gonna wait and see how long it is till he recognizes us. and see what happens. So he gets about like 20 feet from the car, man, and his eyes go from like normal to like softball size, and we make eye contact, man, and I just smile at him, and he's like, oh fuck. And he turns around. Obviously, he takes off running.
Yeah.
We take off after him in the van, man. And yeah. we end up getting him with some crack. But that was like the closest I came to actually doing my own buy. But it wasn't like a plan. It was spur of the moment. But it was just awesome.
Yeah.
Because it's fun when those impromptu or spontaneous things happen, in which they do when you're a plainclothes officer, because, you know, obviously the user, the solicitor, didn't have a clue we were cops, but, you know, sure as shit, dude that knew us was like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll tell stories later on some other episode about officers who would do quick sales like that or quick buys and stuff, not long term, like, you know, gang infiltrations, but
right.
Yeah, yeah. You sometimes you have to depend on a detective to buy, you know, drugs or a gun or something like that. You know, short term stuff. And it used to be comical because we had freedom on patrol at that time and we're expected to on certain days of the month that were all proactive. So we didn't even answer 911 calls. We had overlap. And so it was like, well, if you were the proactive squad, you better come up with something. So we would actually run prostitution projects, buy bust and stuff as officers. So it's funny when your coworker has to go out there and solicit or.
Oh yeah. The prostitution stuff.
Yeah.
That's the best, man. We can do a whole episode on that funny stuff.
So when we were talking about back to informants.
Hang on. We'll give them a little teaser of what that whole episode could be like, right? Because, you know, like when people are out soliciting sex and it's really what they're doing and it's we'll call them a John looking for a prostitute, you know?
Yeah.
They use the street terminology that you would use, but you get an officer trying to do that. It's like, how much if you unzipped my pants and took out, you know?
Right.
And they're like, what? Yeah. we're saving that, man.
Yeah, I would say the funny thing is no one got any training back then. It was hey. And sometimes it was throw in the new officer. But, oh, yeah, it's no problem. Just jump in the car. you'll pull up. They'll do all the work. But, yeah, that's for another episode. So when we get to so talking about informants, one of the things that I used to run into when I'm trying to explain to people, like, and when I say used to, like, as people come into a unit, like new detectives or new officers, you have to pass on that knowledge. I hope anyway, you know, that people aren't hoarding their knowledge or information. But one of the things that I would see and hear sometimes and then pick up on it and go, oh man, we gotta fine tune this. Like, we got to start sanitizing how we talk when we're talking about information coming in from an informant. This is important for when people are actually working informants or going into those assignments. It's like right now there's going to be some listeners who are, you know, either getting promoted to detective or officers who are getting reassigned to a proactive unit. Cause we've gotten messages from people now that are like, hey, you know, we're starting up a proactive unit. And a lot of us don't know what to do. Like cause they haven't been able to do that for the last few years.
No. And you're touching on a super important topic, man, is just how do you handle an informant. And this to me is probably the most important training or lessons that you can pass on to somebody that's never done any work with an informant, because this is you know, when you're in that line of work and you are dealing with the criminal element, and most of your informants, in my opinion, are criminals, right? I mean, is that your experience? Most of the people that I was you know, working as an informant, they're criminals. They are part of a criminal enterprise, and they're not just petty criminals. They're bad dudes in some way, shape, or form, or bad females. There's male and female informants.
Yeah.
So having that experience and training and knowledge on how to handle an informant is, I think, that's first and foremost the most important information that you need to gain as an officer that's going to be doing that. And you know, you hear those sayings, an officer is only as good as his informant, and I think a better way to say that is an officer is only as good as his ability to control his informant.
Yeah, because when someone gets greedy like that, like a new officer, a new detective, and they're like, oh, I got this informant, and then the informant starts to play him like a fiddle, you know, and starts to give them information that's incorrect, or you know what I'm saying, like they begin to feed on that officer or that detective's ignorance.
So yeah, absolutely.
Not knowing. So,
and dude, to your point, the first time as an officer you get an informant or somebody that wants to come up and give you information, you get giddy. You get excited. It's like, yeah. Oh, it's like winning the big stuffed animal at the carnival, man. It's like, wait. You're going to tell me where a gun is right now and I can go get it, right? You know, I've been looking for the last 12 hours of my shift and I hadn't found anything because I suck at my job, right? But no, then this person's like, hey, you need a stolen gun. I know where one is right now. Dude, you get excited, especially if you're into police work, right? Yeah. So I couldn't agree more. The first time, you know, that happened to me, it's exciting. It's that's police work, man. And that's why you sign up to do a job like that.
Yeah. So, like, and the idea of, and every department kind of works differently in their little, you know, policies and how they do things. But usually most departments, for the most part, will have code names for long-term informants or even, you know, informants that you're actually working, either working their charges off or they're getting paid for their time, but they have a code name. You never really refer to them by their government name. Or obviously you shouldn't, but I mean, most people know you don't do that. Naming someone a code name is even interesting or can even be a mistake, because when you're doing the code name, it has to be something neutral. And this is if you pick it or choose it yourself. So that was always our experience, right? Was that we could just kind of pick and choose the code name. What I've seen is that sometimes people will say, oh yeah, I got to come up with a code name. So we're going to call you. And then they pick a name that is very specific about that person's physical characteristics. Like if they're real big and tall or something, oh, your code name is going to be Biggie. It's kind of like, well, it's still kind of generic, but the problem is going to be if you begin to talk about any information that comes from that source and you use their term, oh, well, code name, or, you know, hey, Biggie told us this, a person you're interviewing or you're debriefing may pick up on something like that. And I know I may be losing some people here, but what I'm saying is the easiest kind of rule is stick with generic, like non-specific code names. It's like, I would stick with food items, songs or band names, sort of, you know,
beef jerky.
right.
pick a name that's gonna make you smile every time you say it, man. Like, hey, let's go get beef jerky and see if she's ready to do some work today.
Right.
That's just funny.
So like weapons, you could use like weapons is a very easy term, and give them a code name that they can be proud of. Like I met this dude, I'm on patrol, I'm just kind of trolling around, you know, looking for something, checking the cuts. And I catch this dude out and about walking around. So we just start talking right there on the corner. And the dude basically is like, look, man, you need to call officer so-and-so. Tells me the officer's real name. And it's like, call this person. I'm their source. I'm like, okay. But when I call this officer, what's your code name? Because that's a way I can check if this guy's a legit informant or not, or informant.
Right.
CI. And so he tells me his code name, and his code name is very embarrassing to him. He does not like this code name. Right. So I'm like, well, I don't. Okay. And he's like, look, my code name is Hot Dog, and I don't like that. Because he's like a grown man, you know. I'm thinking, why would you name this dude Hot Dog? Like, it's just a. But probably the officer was like, I don't know. I got to come up with something. They're eating lunch. He's like, all right, hot dog. You know,
hot dog it is.
Yeah. So it's just like one of those. He's like, I really don't like that name. I was like, oh, okay. So when I talked to the officer, though, he's like, man, he's always bitching about that name. And I'm like, well, why didn't you give him a cool name? Like, why would you call him Hot Dog?
But hey, and you brought up a good point, man. You stop somebody and they tell you they're working for another officer. Mm-hmm. There has to be some respect there in the sense that an officer has cultivated an informant and that informant is now in your custody and saying, hey, I work for BC and you need to call him. Don't make sure you make those phone calls. If you arrest somebody's informant or you have them stopped and they're saying, hey, I work for so-and-so. Well, don't do that thing we were talking about earlier. Oh, you're going to work for me tonight and you can deal with him later. Like there has to be a mutual understanding and a mutual respect for the officers that have put into work to A, cultivate that informant, and B, again, like I spoke earlier, you don't know if that guy's on a contract with the DA's office. That informant could be involved in a case way bigger than you'll ever imagine. So I just wanted to throw that out there that, you know, if somebody's claiming to be an informant, treat that as very, very, very sensitive information and make sure that you make the appropriate, phone calls and get down to the bottom of what they're saying, whether it's right or wrong, but take those precautionary measures. And you don't ever want to use somebody's informant without them knowing or try and steal an informant. Yeah. Stuff like that happens. And the only reason I'm talking about it is because we've lived through it. We've dealt with stuff like that and you can get through it, but it makes it tough dealing with another officer like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's enough to go around. You don't have to be greedy about it. So one of the things that I think probably the most important aspect to using informants, to me anyway, and you and I've talked about it a lot and worked it, is the ability to disrupt a cycle of violence using informants. It's like you used an informant earlier. You talked about for the bank robbery stuff, mm-hmm. but using informants to gain information on cycles of violence. So if you have, and I'm going to use these very generically, right? It's just Bloods and Crips, right? And let's just say a Blood set and a Crip set are having beef or they're having violence. If you have informants in both of those sets, you actually, you can stay ahead of some of that violence. If you don't have sources in those sets, you can't stay ahead of that, right? You're basically flying blindly. So when these shootings begin to pop off and there seems to be a pattern or there's no pattern at all, but you know some of the players are gang related, without informants, you have no real-time information. You see this same pattern going through history. You see it back when the 1990s, America gains technology of these satellites and they can zoom in on countries and hostile areas. And then they start to pull out actual assets and resources that the CIA had, basically the CIA's informants overseas. As you pull back on human intelligence and depend basically on a satellite, you don't know the actions on the ground. You don't know what the thoughts and the plans are moving forward. Same thing in the gang world, where if we're on our A game and we're working these informants, you can actually see the violence it reduces in those cities.
Oh, absolutely. And we've proven that. I mean, we lived that, which is so cool, is I don't have to refer to any other stat or some other department. Like, we did it. And that's how we know it's proven and it works. That's the cool part.
Right. So the whole idea, the whole problem that one we're facing, the proactive aspects are lacking in cities. I can guarantee you that the art of developing informants and intelligence like that is lacking as well. So every city that you see that, you're seeing the spikes, increasing in this violence, gang violence, and people I think are losing why informants are so important. Why is it so important that at 9 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock in the morning or whenever it is, I have information coming in from a person who says, hey, this is going to happen inside of half an hour, or hey, so-and-so is going to go to this hotel and blast this dude. Like, he's already on the menu. He's on the list. We have to put in work, or they have to put in work, or whatever, that this is going to happen. With that bit of information, I could then coordinate with a unit and disrupt that cycle. I could get them to be able to stop that car or stop those guys before they get to that hotel, or if nothing else, if I don't even have a team that can act on it, can I even call up a blue and white or a black and white or a patrol unit, whatever you call it in your city, and have them staged in that motel with their blue lights on, like they're doing some type of police activity. And that guys who are going to shoot up that hotel now roll in and go, that's hot. Like, we can't do what we're going to do. They move on. The reason I say that is this has happened time and time and time again. Shootings were prevented, and the feedback comes in, it's too hot. And then the source calls and says, damn, man, y'all did it. I'm like, yeah, that we did it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I both did it. Like, we just prevented somebody's kid from getting shot. We just prevented the neighborhood from getting shot, you know, or shot up. Like this is what we do. And even though the source may be tied into crime or criminal activity, they feel good about that. Like most gang members don't feel good when kids are getting shot or little babies. I mean, that's
no, just absolutely. So and I think BC is driving this point home because there are people that do not think that the police should be working informants for whatever reason. They have these opinions on, well, it's not fair. You're making them do this, or you're forcing somebody to do that, or you shouldn't be able to do that. That should be illegal. Whatever the opinion is, it, you know, as it stands right now, it's a perfectly legal practice backed by, you know, statutes and case law and all that. So, and I think BC hopefully is driving the point home enough to where if you're on the fence as to whether or not police should be using citizen information to stop crime, make arrests and all that, then I mean, listen to these stories that we're kind of talking back and forth with, and it's just a tool of the trade, and it's one of the best tools.
I'll give you a prime example. If for people who are critics or are not under, you know, not supporting informant work, don't think about it in the criminal aspect of drug networks or gangs. Think about it at the way it applies to the Klan, the KKK, right? So I grew up in the South, and you had the Klan that dominated the South. It was a terrorist organization that they lynched people, they destroyed families, they suppressed votes. Absolutely horrible part of our history in the U.S. But also, that same organization was dismantled when the FBI basically started putting operations in play and started flipping people and started using informants from within the claverns across the South. And so you start to see roundups and arrests that were very strategic, and you start to break the back of that entire organization. That's the power of informants. And when people started to cooperate, they could tell what the whatever ceremonies were for the Klan, when they were going to do these, you know, cross burnings and things, and the whole secret society that they had. So then when future Klan members were getting arrested, FBI agents could walk into a room and say, I know when you were, like I would say, brought home in the gang world, but like, I know when you were recruited into the Klan, I know your role in the Klan, I know all these you know, like breaking down all the secrecy. Now that person has to decide, how many years in federal prison are you willing to do for the Klan? Or do you want to cooperate, right? That's the power of informants. So
absolutely.
So that's why I sound like I'm getting on a soapbox, but I get really upset when people will criticize and say, well, you're talking about using informants, and all you're really doing is people are getting in trouble with criminal charges, and then they lie on their friends, and then you go and arrest their friends. And it's like, no, that's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm talking
not one bit.
Yeah, I'm talking about developing sources, getting that accurate information, and then acting on it. And dismantling an entire set. I mean, with very active informants within a gang, you can dismantle that set. You can sit down with the team like we've done and be very strategic and say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to work here, 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 here. These are the most violent people in this organization, and this is who we have to focus on. And if we focus on these key players, part of this entire group will kind of dismantle itself.
Yeah, and I think it's a perfect segue into, you know, there's cardinal rules for you know, firearms and shooting. Like, there's the basic fundamentals of shooting. I think it's important to touch on, you know, and this is going to be very beneficial to any law enforcement officers listening, but also the people on the outside looking in going, yeah, I don't know how this relationship works. How does the officer and the informant relationship exist, and what does that actually look like? First and foremost, if you're a police officer, an informant is not your friend. Mm-hmm. Okay, I cannot stress that enough. And if it turns into a relationship where you end up being friends with an informant, which that's never happened to me, but I will say this, when you work an informant or a source long term, you do get to know them on a more personal level. Mm-hmm. You know, just through basic conversation, you know, sometimes you may be picking them up in a vehicle and you're just, you know, small talk, shooting the shit on your way to go to do a buy, or maybe you're doing surveillance and you have your informant in the car with you so they can identify somebody for you. You do end up having these general conversations, but it's imperative that an informant is not your friend. It doesn't mean that there can't be a mutual respect and a good working relationship, but like, you're not buddies. You're not texting after work. You're not going out and getting beers, and you're not, you know, that's crossing the line. And if it ever gets there or you feel like you're becoming friends, you need to address that with your sergeant, and you need to say, I can't work this person anymore. It's personal now. So that's one of the big ones. And there's a few more I'll touch on, but I'll let BC.
No, for me, when there were certain people I worked that there was a almost like a mentorship.
Yeah, absolutely. You do form a bond.
Yeah, yeah. Where I was gonna say, like, where their personality types were, they had joined this certain set or their set at a young age. They came up through the ranks, and then they realized, you know, that at whatever 22, 23, you know, that they had made a lot of mistakes. So while we're working cases, we can also talk about, you know, what do you plan on doing in the future? Like, what is the exit strategy? Like, you cannot continue down this path. And those are, you know, they're everyone's got a different personality. You know, there were a lot of sources that were just buying drugs at the time, and that's all they wanted to do and get paid or whatever. But there were guys that I had worked that were, you know, young enough to where they could actually change their lives. So a lot of our conversations went from very active gang stuff to kind of a maintenance stat, you know, where we're just kind of maintaining some stuff. And then the conversations would shift into, yo, I've never had a job before. Like,
right. Yeah, absolutely.
I know you haven't. Like, you know, these are the things that I've been telling you about. Like, yep. And then you find out that this young man is not scared of getting shot in the street, not scared of a rival gang, but scared of rejection, scared of walking mm-hmm. into a job interview and not knowing what to do, or going in and then someone not hiring him. And so small things like that, but you're right. Like, when you start crossing the line with anything with like consuming alcohol or relationships or all that stuff is crazy.
I like the term mentor, but you just have to be very, very aware of any relationship that forms, right? Because, you know, if you're, you know, that particular informant might want to consider you their friend, which is, it's okay. But again, you're not buddies. You're not friends. You're not pals. You are on, you know, an agreement. You're on a contract. You're working terms. There's a business end to this relationship, but it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, I like the term mentor, but it's a slippery slope, right?
Yeah. I think that as long as the person is genuine and is not trying to manipulate the officer
right.
or the agent, then yeah, you've got something good there. Cause I actually know an officer who developed the source, and that guy would tell everybody, like, talking about the officer, he's like, that's the only dude in my life that actually calls and checks on me, asks me how I'm doing, if I got a ride to and from work, like, am I staying on course right? He's like, man, nobody else is doing that. As a matter of fact, everybody else wants to take from me. Oh, you got a job, so let me borrow some money, or let you know, I know you don't have a car, so look, ride with me. I'll give you a ride, and then on the ride to work, you know, they're trying to talk them into doing some stupid stuff. But that guy made really good money and was a gang member, made money also as a paid informant. But that officer developed him, and they had a bond only in that sense that guy was like, he thought that all cops were out there to arrest him. And then two, he saw that this guy's actually a human being.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Couple of the big ones. You never meet an informant alone. And I think that kind of feeds into what we were just talking about, man, is always have that second set of eyes and ears. Mm-hmm. To just kind of keep everything in check. And, you know, again, you're dealing with people of the criminal enterprise and in the criminal underworld too. What's to say that your informant one day is not going to go, fuck it, I'm done with this shit, and here's an easy target, right? So don't ever let your guard down. That's a good rule of thumb. The other thing is, and I think this is a huge one, is if you're an officer and you're trying to convince somebody of something, do not ever make any promises. I can't stress that enough. Like, if you do this for me, then I guarantee you that you're going to make this amount of money, or I guarantee you the DA drops your charges. Yeah. Do not make any promises. And you want to know why? Is because they're going to hold you to that.
Mm-hmm.
If you tell somebody, hey, if you do this for me, I'm going to do this for you, you better do it. Because at the end of the day, you're still dealing with another human being that has real life consequences, and you're literally the puppet master, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't promise somebody like, oh yeah, you do these deals for me, and you know, I'm going to get you out of this. Well, shit, if you don't know that you can 100% do that, and it's not written on paper, signed by a DA and a judge and all this other stuff, do not make a darn promise. Because what's going to happen is they're going to do the work, and that promise is going to fall through, and that person's going to go, you fucked me. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you just made it personal. And that's very, very dangerous.
Yeah. And we're talking about informants. Obviously, officers out there and detectives are going through training and going through classes and learning this stuff in a very structured environment. But that idea, like you just said, of promising, or you should never have to convince somebody to work necessarily as a source. Like it, and when I say it, like you just said, like you, if you're sitting there telling them, oh, I'm going to do this for you, I'm going to do that.
It's dangerous.
You know? Yeah.
It's a slippery slope, man.
Because you are kind of saying things that you can't, you don't have control over.
Right.
You can't say that. You can't do that.
And I don't want to get too technical, man, but just, you know, another thing to remember is they're not part of your squad. They're not a sworn officer. They may seem like they're on your unit because you deal with them so much, or yourself and your squad mates see this informant on a regular basis because they're providing so much information, or they're such a big part of the case you're working. But they're not sitting in on your briefings. They don't need to know all your police tactics, and they only need to know what they need to know. So don't bring them into the mix as if they're on your squad, right? You have to always just maintain that professionalism and that relationship. And, you know, I could talk for this about 8 hours, and I'm not going to do that, but I just thought it's important to touch on some of those very basic handling skills. And, you know, like BC mentioned earlier, we're just hitting the tip of the iceberg on this and kind of giving people a glimpse into that world and what the relationship between an officer and informant looks like, and the value and the benefits of an informant, and just kind of how to do that. But if you're in law enforcement and you want to know more, at the very end of this episode, we'll put our email address out if you're not comfortable on social media, and you can actually just email us privately, and we can get you hooked up with some information, or if we don't have it, we can, you know, point you in the right direction.
And but there's probably been, I don't know, man, maybe like 5 or 6 people within the last 2 weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks, that have sent messages about applying for departments, and getting serious about getting into police work, which to me is like, man, you know, it, that I'm motivated by that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's this idea of people, we're talking about this stuff and we're kind of starting to try to shed some light into the different aspects of police work that people are going to have to kind of follow in those footsteps. Like when they join the departments, they're going to get into some really good police work and not get caught up in this cycle of negativity. Or if someone says like that, like we talked about earlier, like, oh, you want to be a cop, but you're going to go out there and hem people up, or you're going to, you know, get into this whole drug war on drugs, which is a farce and it's, you know, a sham and all that. Well, okay, whatever. Like for right now, like just stay focused with wanting to be a cop, you know.
I got a good rebuttal on that, man, and I don't want to get into the debate on the war on drugs, but my experience as a police officer is the drug world, whether you think, let's just use marijuana, all right, whether you think it should be legal or illegal, it's irrelevant. What I can tell you is the criminal enterprise that illegally sells an illegal substance is usually tied to a lot of other crimes, to include violent crimes, right? So if I can arrest somebody for a dime bag of marijuana and search them incident to arrest and pull a handgun out of their waistband, I probably just prevented a shooting. So think about it like that. I'm not chasing the drugs, and no, I don't think I'm going to arrest enough people to get all the marijuana off the streets and solve that problem. No, but I am using the drug laws as a tool to curb violent crime in the city I work. So that's the way I view it. I'm a drug cop, but not because I think I can cure the drug problem in America. It's just because I like the crimes associated with the people that illegally sell drugs. And it ties back to everything BC and I keep talking about, and curbing violent crime and making the city safer, because that's what police officers are supposed to do. So there's my soapbox on the war on drugs, man.
Yeah, I think we'll do an episode on drug strategy. I think we should do
absolutely.
A whole episode in the future on drug strategies and things going on. I will say, I had an informant buy drugs from a guy who was a sex offender. So just kind of keep in mind that people who are selling drugs are also into some really violent crimes with guns, but also into like sex crimes. You get into human trafficking, you get into all of that. So it was good that I was able to do that. So keep in mind that, like you just said, you go out there and you arrest somebody for a drug charge, it gets you into a search, you recover a gun, and that's all part of disrupting that cycle of violence that, hey, this person's rolling with a gun. And that's right now, that's why a lot of the gun violence is the way it is. Every dude is on the block now with a gun. So when they bump heads and somebody's got beef, instead of either fighting and somebody has to run to go get a gun from either a car or their house, they got it right in their waistband. They pull it out, boom, and they shoot and kill people.
So we need to talk about, we need to talk about proactive policing. We need to talk about specifically drug work. We got a whole bunch of stuff that we need to cover, man.
Yeah, and we'll bring in some people in the future to actually who have lived that life to be able to talk about why they do what they do or did what they did, all that stuff. The most important question I'm thinking about, I don't know if it's time yet to ask any music questions.
Of course it's time.
I'll hold off. So since we're talking about this topic, is it true that your favorite artist was a guy named Snow who had a song called Informant? Is that true? You don't even know. You know what I'm talking about?
Somebody gonna day. I like it. Boom boom now. Is that what you're referring to, man? See?
Yeah. The tape you had. You had a cassette tape, I think.
Man, I did have an informer. I like the spin you put on that, though, man. Snow Informant.
I've been dying to just bring up music for a little while, but no.
Man, it's hard not to. We might just have to have a whole separate show that's just all about music, man.
So we are, man. I got a dude waiting in the wings who, man, we messaged quite a bit, and I'm not going to give anything away yet. That dude knows a lot about music, I mean, like a lot of just like off the top of his head. So it'll be good, man. He was making some jokes about the song you sang not too long ago in an episode or something. Oh man, I can't remember now. Mannequin, maybe, or no?
Come on, man. I was having a moment.
Okay, hey, first off, what? Okay, I always like to ask this question to people, and they never answer it honestly. What's one musician or song that you love, but you are very embarrassed to ever admit it, or you would be upset if I walked up to your covert vehicle and you're sitting in there just rocking it out to man, whoever?
This is easy. I don't even have to think about it. I love vocalists, male, female, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely love Whitney Houston.
Oh.
Okay. And I will sing the heck out of, you know, not I Want to Dance with Somebody, but the song I Have Nothing. Okay. I would be just mortified if somebody walked up and caught me in my car because I try and sing that song the way she sings it. Oh. And it's straight up embarrassing, man, but it makes me emotional. Yeah. So I just, I get emotional when I sing it, man, because she's so good. So there you have it. Does it get any more raw than that?
No. But you know, you get a little bit of like whatever credibility or something. I don't know whatever you want to call it. That I mean, like millions of people like Whitney Houston.
Yeah.
So you can get away with that. Now singing it, that would actually be pretty funny. Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
I'll do that on another episode. What about you, man?
Yeah. So there's. There's a musician that I like to listen to. Not now as an adult, it wouldn't matter. But man, as a kid, like a young teenager, fifth, sixth, seventh grade around there, people would dog me out, man, if they knew I was listening to it. So I would listen to it secretly. Little Kenny Rogers.
Come on, man. I'm
serious. Like as an adult, I can say that and people would be like, oh, you like Kenny Rogers? Big deal. But man, as like a little skater kid who's listening to like punk rock and hardcore, man, I fell in love with the song Coward of the County because I love story. You know, I like music where you hear, you know, you're telling a story.
As a kid, man, you'd have got like punched for that.
Dude, my brother would have body slammed me.
You'd have got pink belly.
Elbow, man.
You remember pink belly, man? We pull up the shirt and everybody slaps the stuff.
Yeah. So what? Tell me. I think that's maybe a regional thing.
Yeah, man.
Down here.
Let me ask you a question about Kenny Rogers, man, and then we'll wrap it up. You think him and Dolly were knocking boots, or were they really just friends?
I don't know, dude. They wrote. They sang Islands in the Stream, right?
I think they had a little something going on.
They
may
have. I will tell you, man. I don't know that I heard a bad Kenny Rogers song back then.
I've heard a bunch of bad Kenny Rogers songs. Every fucking one of them is bad, BC. Man, that's why you should be embarrassed.
Hold on. Have you heard Coward of the County before?
I'll listen to it tonight. But as it stands right now, I'm making a stance. I do not like Kenny Rogers, man. Almost as much as I don't like the band U2.
Whoa.
Yeah, really? I just threw bombs. You know what, man? Before I get upset, we may have to just go ahead and end this, man.
No. Okay, hold on one second. So U2, I like U2, but you're probably talking about like how it got a little kooky and crazy or something, or
no, I just don't like them. Period.
You just don't like them. You just don't dig them.
Nothing.
Yeah. Nah. Yeah. So Kenny Rogers, Coward of the County, man, they even made a made for TV movie. About that is a good one.
Right. Well, I'll come back and give you my honest opinion, man.
Yeah, so give me something good to listen to then. What's something good I should check out?
On the spot right now.
Yeah, I like putting you on the spot because we talk about music all the time, but
I got one for you, man.
Okay.
Screaming Cheetah Wheelies.
Ooh.
The Magnolia album.
Okay. So there people are probably gonna have to Google it, some people, but other people won't. They'll know exactly who you're talking about.
There you go.
Okay. Screaming Cheetah Wheelies.
What about you?
Ooh. Have I said the Marcus King Band before?
No.
I can't remember.
I don't think on an episode you have, man.
I'm going with Marcus King Band. I want to say there's a 2-record set I've got, and I can't remember the name of it. It's got a lion on the face, like the lion mm-hmm. on the cover. Dude. Marcus King Band. I will say I it's hard to like for me to get really impressed with music, but Marcus King Band.
Say no more, BC. It's been a pleasure tonight.
Disruptors out.